It is so good to be in worship with you today. He is risen.
He is risen.
And happy Easter to all of you. It is such a joy to be in worship with you today to celebrate that Jesus is not dead. He is not in the tomb, but he is risen and is alive forevermore. And we are here to celebrate that together today. Amen. Well, this week has reminded me of something. It's reminded me of how much we dislike when beautiful things are ruined. Earlier this week, if you've been watching the news, the Cathedral of Notre Dame caught fire and was ruined. And there were individuals singing and weeping and singing Ave Maria because we hate it when beautiful things are ruined. We don't like when beautiful things are ruined. Just like we don't like when beautiful things are ruined, we absolutely love it when ruined things are restored. There's something inside of all of us that loves to see things that have been destroyed, things that have been ruined, restored back to their original idea that the author or painter had in mind. But not all restoration attempts and projects are equal. Where you're going to see, you see a picture or a statue of St. George in a Spanish cathedral. And this is a picture of St. George on his way, armored St. George, on his way to fight a dragon. Now, this statue is in a cathedral in Spain. The local priest thought that because it was so dull, it needed restoration. And so the local priest asked a volunteer school teacher, local school teacher, to restore this work of art. And this was her attempt at restoring the work of art. Yeah, if the artist had Disney in mind, yeah, she did a good job. But I don't think the artist had Disney in mind. She's like ruined the painting or ruined the sculpture. Here's another one. This is a 20th century fresco in Spain of an image of Jesus. And 80-year-old Cecilia Jimenez volunteered. You gotta watch those volunteers. Volunteered to restore the fresco. As you can see, the paint is chipping. And this was her attempt at restoring the painting. Yeah, she spoiled the fresco. But that city became famous because it became a tourist attraction for all the wrong reasons, because everyone wanted to see how badly the fresco was ruined. Here's another one. It's probably one of my favorites. This is a sculpture of the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus. Virgin Mary and baby Jesus. This is in Sudbury, Canada. And so at the hand of vandals, a particular vandal chipped off the head of baby Jesus and stole it. So Heather Wise, an artist, again volunteered to replace the head. And this was her attempt at restoring. That's baby Chuck E. Jesus right there. Check this out. The locals were so horrified and embarrassed by this. The man who stole it was so embarrassed, he returned the head. Huh. returned the head, and they actually restored it back to its original, the original sculpting. As you can see, these are failed attempts at restoration. Failed attempts at restoration. As much as people desire to restore things, you gotta have some level of credentials to be able to restore things that have been ruined. You know, not only do we love it when art is restored, when cars are restored, when furniture is restored, there's something inside of all of us that absolutely love it when people are restored, when marriages are restored, when finances and health are restored. Even when people's relationships with God are restored. I would imagine some people who are listening to me right now on campus as well as online, there's something deep inside of you that when you walked in the doors, there's something deep inside of you. You probably never articulated it, but you're saying, I need to be restored. Well, the Easter story is about restoration. The Easter story is about being restored to God's original intention and God's original purpose. We're going to take a look at the Easter story today, and we're going to look at how God restores broken people, how God restores ruined pieces of art, how God restores disobedient people, failures like us. You see, the Easter story is not a myth. It's not a figment of someone's imagination. It's not a made-up story. It is a story. It is a story that had over 500 witnesses in the text and individuals who have experienced the risen Lord personally. It's not a myth. It's not a made-up story. It is a true story about a person who was dead, was buried, and rose again on the third day. The Easter story is not a myth. It's not a myth. So if you have a copy of the scriptures, turn with me to Mark chapter 16. If you don't have a Bible, don't worry about it. There are Bibles that are that the church has provided in the rack in front of you. Also, the verses will be on the screens as well. Mark chapter 16, this is what it says. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome, not to be confused with Salami, bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe. And they were alarmed, and he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." So the text says, when the Sabbath had passed, that is after the Sabbath. And the Sabbath, for those of you who are brand new to the Bible, brand new to church, brand new to Christianity, the Sabbath is a 24-hour period of time from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. It was instituted back in the Old Testament after God had delivered the people of his people from Egyptian bondage. And they had worked and worked and worked their hands, and like they did not get a break. And so God instituted the Sabbath to give them rest, to say, you can stop working for a 24-hour period of time and the world will not break and fall apart. You can actually experience me for a 24-hour period of time and to trust me to make provisions for you. So these women observed the Sabbath. And after that Sabbath period had passed, they brought spices to the tomb. Now, the text says the tomb. Now, you may not be able to see it, but the tomb in Greek is emphatic. That is the tomb. The reason why that's important is because there were stories that said the women were so distraught as they made their way to the tomb. They were so distraught that they did not know which tomb. They were weeping, and so they did not. So Mark makes us know that the women came to the tomb, the same tomb that they saw Jesus buried in Mark chapter 15, verse 47. So Mark says, it's the tomb. Make no mistake, it is the same tomb Jesus was buried in, and they came to that same tomb. So when they come to that tomb, they bring spices, and they bring spices for at least two reasons. See, Jews did not embalm bodies like the Egyptians, and so they brought spices to show their devotion to Jesus, number one, but to also to put spices on the body of Jesus that was already in their minds decomposing. So they weren't even thinking resurrection. They were just simply bringing spices to show their love and to cover up the smell. So in their grief and sadness, they forgot. On their way to the tomb, they say, well, wait a minute, who is going to roll the 2-ton stone away from the mouth of the tomb? I don't know, maybe they should have called Dwayne the Rock Johnson to move the stone. Okay, that's a bad dad joke, I'm sorry. But one scholar did say he found it very ironic that none of Jesus's followers, none of his male followers were there. We ought to give it up for all the women in the house who just remain to be faithful, yeah. So they get to the tomb and they're inside the tomb. Stone was already rolled away. Now, the stone was rolled away not so Jesus could get out. The stone was rolled away so people could get in and see the evidence that it was empty. So they get there, and there's a man, there's an angel there, and he says to the women that, I know you're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene. He is not here. He has risen. And Mark writes it in what we call the divine passive. And the divine passive is this, is that Jesus didn't raise himself up. God raised Jesus from the dead. The resurrection is God's initiation. The resurrection is God's idea to prove that everything that Jesus said about himself was actually true. And so they look and the tomb is empty. That is the Easter story. But what relevance does that story have to our lives today? What relevance does that story, this amazing story, this powerful story, have in our lives today? As a single mother, as a single father, as a married couple, as children, as teenagers, what in the world does this have to do with us today? Men and women who work every day, what does this story have to do? What relevance does it have in our lives today? Well, in order for us to understand that, we have to look at verse number 7. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. I'm going to read that again. But go tell his disciples, and I want us to say together, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. The angel says, and Peter. The Greek says, even Peter, and particularly Peter. Why does Mark include those words right here? Before I give you the answer to that, there's one scholar by the name of O.S. Hawkins. He actually says if it was up to us, we would have given the angel words of antagonism, words of taunting. Go tell the disciples and Pilate, the one who crucified, sentenced Jesus to death, and actually had him crucified. Now, I think I would have loved that. I think I would have loved rubbing it in Pilate's face. I would have absolutely loved doing that, because I'm petty like that. I'm a petty pastor. I really am. To prove it, a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I took our daughter to on a college tour to Durham, North Carolina. And just so happened in the providence of God, we were in Durham when the Spartans beat the Duke Blue Devils. Woo! Yeah. So the day after our first visit to the first school, because we went to the University of North Carolina, and Duke, the first school we went to the day after the victory was Duke University. This is how your boy rolled up onto the campus of Duke University. Man, I had people looking at me like, we rode the bus, and one guy said, "Hey, bro, it's too soon. It's too soon." One guy said, "This is just plain cruel that you would do this." And so I would have loved to antagonize Pilate, because that's just how I am. And so he did not use words of antagonism. Oh, as Hawkins said, he could have used words of, if it was up to us, we would have had him to use words of appreciation. Go tell the disciples and John. John was the one who stood next to Jesus, or he was there when Jesus was being crucified. In fact, John was the one who was faithful to Jesus. And Jesus says, "Hey, why don't you take care of my mother after I'm gone?" So he could have used words of appreciation. But Hawkins said he uses words of affection. He says, "I want you to go tell the disciples and Peter." Why does he single Peter out? Out of all the 10 other disciples, why does he single him out? Why does he call him by name? Well, in order for us to understand that, we actually have to go back and look at Jesus' last contacts with Peter. So I want you to turn back a few pages to Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, and the verses will be on the side screens. Mark chapter 14, verses 27 and 28. Okay, it was late Thursday evening, and Jesus and his disciples, they're having dinner, what we call the Last Supper. During dinner, this is what Jesus says. And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I am raised, I will go before you to Galilee.'" And Peter, being overconfident, in verse 29, Peter said to him, "Even though they all fall away, I will not fall away." And then Jesus, upon hearing what Peter said, Peter has been faithful to Jesus up to this point. And this is what Jesus says to Peter. He says, "Truly, I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he said emphatically, I'm your ride or die. I'm your dog. I'm your boy. That's kind of what it says, but I'm kind of Marvinizing a little bit. I'm going to be with you. I will never leave you. I will never deny you. I will be there with you through thick and thin. I'm your boy. He says, "I will be there." So they finish the meal and they go out to the Garden of Gethsemane, place where Jesus typically prays. And he goes out and he tells Peter, James, and John, "Hey, listen, I want you to stay here while I pray." He takes all the disciples and then he brings Peter, James, and John a little bit closer. And he says, "Listen, I want to the disciples as well as to Peter, James, and John. I want you to stay here, watch and pray, because you're about to experience a temptation that will be stronger than you've ever experienced before in your life. And the only way you're going to be able to handle this temptation is that you have to remain connected with the Father." This is what he tells them. And then he goes away and he prays to the Father. And then when he comes back, verses 37 and verse 38, and he came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. At this point, Jesus goes back and prays again, comes back and finds them sleeping, and this time, the guards come to arrest Jesus. Verse 66. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also were with the Nazarene Jesus. But Peter denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you mean. And he went out into the gateway of the and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, this man is one of them. But again, he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. And immediately the rooster crowed a second time, and Peter remembered how Jesus said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. In a moment of great pressure, in a moment of fear, Peter denies Jesus. He says he doesn't know him. You know, typically when we think we're too strong and we can't fall, that's the moment we fall. Listen to what St. Bonaventure says when in his book, A Major Life of St. Francis of Assisi. When you are too sure of yourself, you are less on guard against the enemy. Be alert, therefore, for the devil who, if he can claim even one hair on your head, will lose no time in making a braid of it. This is very strange that Peter would deny Jesus, because Peter has been around Jesus for 3 years and he has seen some pretty fantastic stuff. He has seen demons cast out. He has seen people healed. He saw a 12-year-old girl raised back to life. He saw Jesus walk on water. I mean, he hung out with Jesus. He saw Jesus multiply loaves and fish. And yet in this moment, he says, I don't know him. I don't know what you're talking about. It would be like me saying of my wife of almost 25 years, after we have shared our vows together, we have 3 children, we have pictures in our house, all over the house. She makes me laugh like no other. She makes me guffaw. She makes this amazing pot roast that I got to hurry up and finish because she's cooking it right now. It would be like me in a moment of pressure, in a moment of fear. Girl, I don't know you. That would not only be painful, but that would be my last day on planet Earth. Because she would kill me. But Peter says, I don't know him. This is one of the greatest failures in the New Testament. And everybody in this room said, how could he? How could he do something like that? He'd been with Jesus 3 years. How could he? Shame on Peter. Before we criticize Peter too much, before we throw him under the bus, we are all Peter. We are all Peter. We have all failed Jesus. In a moment of fear, in a moment of distress, we have said things that we said we would never say. We have done things that we said we would never do. And we promised Jesus things, and we've gone back on those promises. We are all Peter. I am Peter. You are Peter. We all stand together in the courtyard, in this gateway, saying, yes, we have denied him over and over and over again. I say that I'm going to be a better father, and I end up being a distracted father. I promise God that I'm going to be a more loving husband, and I find myself being a selfish husband. I claim and I promise God that I will no longer manage an image, but I find myself saying I am better than I am. I say that I will never be like my mother or father, and I find myself doing the things like my mother and father did. Peter Scazzaro says, Jesus may be in your heart, but grandma is in your bones. There are sometimes we make all of these promises, and there are people who are listening to me right now. You said that you would not let the scale define your identity. You have said that you would no longer be materialistic, and you've gone back on those promises. You said that you would no longer have sex outside of marriage, and you find yourself breaking that promise. My friends, we are all Peter. We have all denied Jesus in some way or another. Why does the angel say to the women, make sure you tell the disciples and Peter? You know why? Because Peter needed restoration. Peter needed life breathed into his soul. Peter needed someone to let him know that his failure was not final. He needed to know that he did not commit the unforgivable sin, that Jesus has invited him to restoration. Jesus had invited him to acceptance. Jesus wanted Peter to know that you're no longer rejected. Remember, Peter is the one who is giving Mark this information. And Peter says, Mark, make sure you include and Peter in this text, because I want people everywhere to know that God's gracious hand can bring them back when they've walked far away. Peter is saying this to Mark, make sure you let them know that their failure is not final, and that they can be restored, and they are not rejected and condemned and judged, but the one who is risen from the grave says, and Peter, and Marvin, and Justin, and Bob, and Mary, and John, and you fill in the blank, your name. This is a two-word gospel for every single person who is listening to me right now. This is a message of restoration. This is a message of accept. This is a message of new life. I love what one scholar says, that Peter's failure was not the last word about his life. The last word belongs to the risen Savior. And it's not a word of judgment. It's not a word of condemnation. It is a word of restoration. It is a word of love. It is a word of forgiveness. It is a word of acceptance. It is a word that says, I love you. And Peter is actually saying, if this is a word of hope for a traitor like me, it's a word of hope for traitors like us. This is included, and I'm so glad it's included for people like me and for people like you. You see, Easter is not just a system of beliefs. Easter is about a real person who died and rose again, and right now, he calls you by name. He calls you by name. Just like he did Peter, he calls you by name. And he calls us to remind us that he loves us and he forgives us and that he restores us.